Stay tuned for The Turning Point. Oh, I see. I'm on the radio. I have to say something. Well, you know, I used to think, after having been on the radio for 35 years, I used to think, and it didn't end so long ago, that the words I said on the radio, that the emotion and the words and the drama I brought to things, that my impassioned, compassionate, whatever, you know, strident speech, my desperate speech, would actually change things in the world. I don't know. Maybe that's left over from childhood. You know, that magical wish, I guess it's stronger in some people than other people, depending on how you grow up, that something you could say or do can help your parents. Let's say you have a—I mean, this doesn't apply to everybody, obviously, or maybe it's on a continuum. The extent that your parents communicate to you, either directly or unconsciously, the fact that they— are sad or miserable or angry or dissatisfied, or that they have a bad job, or that they're arguing with their wife or their husband. The fact that your parents are unhappy, it's a natural thing in kids to want to fix that, because when you're young, your parents are the source of everything. When you're a child and you're a toddler, you worship them. When you're in, you ever see the look in an infant's eyes, maybe a 6 month or an 8 month year old or a 4 month old, they look at you and you're like God. I mean, it's a gaze that sometimes it's hard to meet when you're a parent and you see this little child look at you, and you're doing everything. I mean, they would perish within a day or two if you didn't actually feed them and clean them up and make sure that they were safe and warm and everything else. And that goes for toddlers, too. And straight up until, you know, ages 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, gets to be 10, 11, 12, 13, depending on how precocious a kid is or how aware they are of the world, then you as an idol start to develop cracks and you might crash, which is a source of great distress to a lot of kids. And they it's one of those developmental bumps of a very serious nature when they... It's not that they're just dissatisfied or in a bad mood, but when they've always looked to you as somebody who is more or less perfect or godlike, especially the better parent you are, when they start to see cracks and failures, when they start to see that they might, when you might just be wrong about something, or you make mistakes, which everybody does, of course, or you treat them in a way which is not exactly right. Not according to their to the way, you know, like they're in a bad mood or something, but you just don't do the right thing, or you're in a bad mood. This starts to change again. But basically, I think kids start off adoring their parents, and then it takes a lot for parents to destroy that. And my case was extreme, so I sometimes judge other cases as being like mine on a continuum, some as bad as mine, but some not as bad as mine, most not as bad as mine, which is good, where parents seem to be doing their utmost, in my case, to destroy that image of, and yet it won't go away. I think I mentioned this last week. There's a lot of overlap on these shows because the themes are always the same in the end. It's about parents and children and love and hate and life and death. But even if a parent, you know, is really miserable and mean and bad and neglectful or abusive, still a kid will try and try and try up to a certain point. Then they will turn inward and take it out on themselves and still blame themselves. This could happen way into adulthood, if there is any such thing. The reason I mention all this is that for years, I mean, it's 35 years now, and I've talked a lot about politics. I've had separate shows on politics. I've talked about politics on my one show I had, a weekly show on BAI in New York City for 25 years, and I would throw a lot of politics in there, and I've interviewed politicians and people who write about politics and historians, read a lot of newspaper articles, took a lot of calls. Somehow I always thought that I had the solution. That if I could be, this is the childlike, this is the link to that childhood thing I was talking about. I thought if I could really, you know, come up with an impassioned enough plea or some sort of solution, this is really grandiose, obviously, that it contributes somehow to, but, you know, obviously that's just one voice, small voice blowing in the wind. Because, I mean, when I look at the world now, I see what goes on. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And it could be because I'm approaching a clearer line of mortality, that I'm getting older and recent, you know, serious illnesses, various illnesses I had have sort of given me a really serious preview of my mortality, which is something... I also felt that if I talked enough, this is like something from a fairy tale, right? If I talked enough and I said the right things, that I would somehow magically unlock a key to immortality, that I would stave off sickness, illness, loss, death. And it was kind of a self-hypnosis in a way. When I look at the world now and I look at, it's hard to read the paper. It breaks your heart. Breaks your heart. If you care about other people, and I don't mean if you just fixed on one country or one tribe or one group and another. Obviously, in most cases, there is one group. You could usually pick out one group that, at any given time, is being dominated or oppressed by a larger group. But I don't know. It seems to me I have never seen so many people running amok, out of control, declaring revolutions, greed, power, violence of the most extraordinary nature everywhere in the world. And, of course, our own country has always likes to think that it's hovering above all this, that we're spreading democracy, or that whoever we sell our billions and billions or trillions of dollars worth of murderous equipment to, planes and ships and missiles and bombs and small arms and grenades and everything else that we sell all over the world, that we're above all this, that we're actually, we represent, you know, we're the greatest power in the free world, and we represent democracy everywhere. But like I mentioned last week, when the Israelis, a lot of what the Israelis are doing, they buy weapons from various countries and they produce some of their own weapons. But a lot of their heavier weapons are sold to them, basically not sold, actually given to them by the United States. And Hamas, which is shooting, you know, like 100, 150 rockets a day and blowing up houses and now killing people, are, you know, are receiving a lot of their weapons from Syria, from Iran. And so this is obviously always a cause of a global conflict. It's a cause of a global global conflict, too, because it is the Holy Land. And it just breaks my heart. I mean, I look at what's happening in the Ukraine with that jetliner, and these people are out of control, and it's completely manipulative and dishonest. Putin could pick up the phone wherever he is, at his mansion somewhere or in the middle of the Kremlin. He could pick up the phone, make about five calls, and stop all of this. Because these are clearly Russians, Russian troops, Russian commandos, Russian special forces. They're all supplied by Russia. They get their money from Russia, these quote-unquote rebels. Now, I'm sure there are people in the Ukraine, which was very happy to receive its freedom along with a lot of other countries that used to be part of the Soviet Empire. There are a lot of people, you know, but they're a minority. I mean, there's supposed to be some sort of democracy there. But there's a lot of people who, you know, who maybe would, for reasons one or another, who knows why, would prefer, usually has to do with religion or tribal things, would prefer to be part of Russia. Although I don't know why anybody would prefer to be part of Russia with the secret police and lack of freedom of speech and jailing for all kinds of reasons and the utter violence and dictatorial behavior. Nevertheless, when you see this airliner shot down, and inevitably, of course, and I know you feel the same way, it's always there. 80 of the people murdered in this with this missile, which was a Russian missile, very likely or very possibly fired from Russia by Russian soldiers, or at least Russian-trained, quote-unquote, rebels inside the Ukraine. 80 of the people, of the 300 people that were killed, were children. Were children. Are we trying to commit mass suicide on this planet? Is that what's going on? Are there too many people? Is there some urge to just sort of winnow down the number of people? I mean, there's not enough resources, obviously, since we're drying up the whole planet and creating, you know, an atmosphere that's killing everybody, but literally an atmosphere. But, I mean, what is going on here? I mean, are people having too many children? I think probably in some cases they are. Is this a solution? Like Jonathan Swift once suggested something like this for the Irish problem in that the British had with the Irish. There was too many children. So he suggested that since they were starving and there were too many children there, that they could cook and eat their own children, the extra ones, and they would keep the population to a minimum and they'd all have enough food. I don't know what, I have no idea what's going on, but it is heartbreaking. And there's no solution. I mean, am I the only one who feels utterly powerless about this? You see this going on, and in the Congo, 250 girls are kidnapped, and God knows what else has happened to them. Out of a school, 250 kids, children, are kidnapped out of a school by an insane religious group, which is probably not even motivated by religion, just by just sheer monstrousness at this point, just lust and rape and power and greed, Boko Haram or something. And I think that's probably, they're probably Muslim, but it could just as easily be the Lord's Army, which declares itself to be Christian, none of which makes any difference. And then what's going on between Israel and Gaza now. It's just heartbreaking. I mean, you know, like I said last week, and as we all understand, once you start talking about this, you could go on for hours. You enrage people if you take sides. What did Israel imagine? I mean, it's got rockets raining down on it, right? People are in fear for their lives every minute. They're afraid to send their kids to school. Houses are being blown up. Any place in Israel, almost any place, is under threat of explosions, death, sudden death. But what did they expect to get? I mean, they've got to somehow figure out a way to put an end to this. But how are they going to put an end to it? By violence? They've tried this and tried this and tried this. I don't know what you do about Hamas. Hamas is essentially a religious fundamentalist dictatorship. They've done a great deal of good for the people in Gaza. They've built schools. They've built hospitals. They've helped the Gazans when no one else would, not even the Palestinian Authority. But they helped. And when there was a vote several years ago between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas to see who would actually run a united Palestine, Hamas was elected. There had to be reasons why the people preferred that. I don't really know. You know, that's extensive, and I don't know exactly what it was. But I don't know what you're supposed to do. Do the Israelis imagine? Now, about 95% of the world hates the Israelis now. And I'm not too fond of them myself at the moment. But you say, well, they have the right to self-defense. I'm not sure what they're supposed to do. If they've invaded now. And something like the latest thing I read, I'm sure it's up. There's over 500 people now, 500 Palestinians, who are dead as a result of this. Probably 450 of them are civilians. And children, everywhere children. On the front page of the New York Times today, there is a heartrending picture. And, you know, these pictures are printed by people and words are used to create feelings and to create sympathy for either side. The Israelis can probably show you pictures of the, I think, two civilians now in Israel have been killed. They'll show you pictures of their corpses in their smashed apart building where they were or wherever they were killed. But what you basically see, because that's what's going on, are Palestinian kids on a beach. Kids, children. These are not Martian children. These are not baby zebras. These are human being children, like your children, like my children. Can you imagine if you lived in a place and every hour jet planes, bombers were flying over and dropping bombs and missiles, and your kids go out to play on a beach and they're blown to pieces? Can you imagine? Would you be interested in ever making peace with the people that did that? Would you ever want anything but revenge? I mean, ultimately, you can't live your whole life that way, but it seems to me what the Israelis are doing is, and you know, you could say, well, a lot of people hated them to begin with. That's true, the Jews. They didn't have to set up their own country and defend themselves to be hated. You know, that's clear from history. But now, what did they imagine was going to happen with an invasion there? They say they're going to destroy the tunnels that Hamas uses to attack inside Israel, which there are. And these tunnels which they use to hide the missiles that they launch, the rockets that they launch, and the launching equipment, too, I suppose. So they're going to destroy the tunnels. They're just going to build them up as soon as they leave again. And one day I read in the paper that the whole mission is to go in and destroy these tunnels, a specific mission, right? Does that sound familiar? We had a specific mission in Vietnam, a specific mission in Afghanistan and Iraq, right? Once you go in and you start murdering people, and you start killing people, most of them civilians, and you drop bombs all over the place, then you've got a war. And now there's a war going on there. This is not just a headline in a newspaper. It's a war. And who suffers from war eternally? Yes, a lot of soldiers do. But children, civilians, people who, if you ask them, would never want a war in the first place. So, you know, now there's something that's probably hundreds of dead young people and children in Palestine. And what did Israel hope that that they were going to accomplish? Inevitably, I'm sure there were people who wanted a full-scale war. So they've got one now. And it's only going to get worse, probably, once they go in there. And now you read in the paper that, or however you get your news, that it's nothing but pure hatred everywhere. I mean, literal hatred. I mean, there's Twitter and there's Facebook, and everybody's throwing around words. Israeli teenagers are calling them all snakes, devils, assassins. The Palestinians are calling the Israelis Nazis, and it's all over Twitter and Facebook or whatever, you know, nonsense is being spread around all over the place. I don't know. I mean, it just breaks my heart. I no longer am under the impression that anything I say here can change anything in the world, obviously, that I thought that was truly nuts and grandiose. But I preserved my childhood fantasies much longer, and still do, than, you know, the majority of other human beings. Sometimes I think, and I know, actually, that something I've said on this show changes the way other people feel about themselves or how they feel about their own lives in a simple way and how they go about living their lives. So that's always something that I'm grateful that I can do. And it since I can't ever help my parents, which was the origin of all these impassioned tales I used to tell on the air, at least there's other people I can help. It seems as if I'm just cutting off in the middle about this, but I don't know what can be done about this. And I'm sure people have solutions. I have some ideas. I mean, one of the reasons that Hamas acts the way it does is for its own interests. I mean, they have very little money. The Egyptians are dead set against them, have closed a lot of their entry and exit points with the Egyptian border. They have shut down tunnels on their side. So they're trapped. They're trapped like rats in Gaza, and the Israelis have closed down their side of the border. And they have nothing to begin with, these people, because the Israelis control their airspace, control their coastline, and control the amount of medicine that gets in there, even the amount of food, hospital equipment. So these people, for the last several decades, have been suffering probably as much or more than any other people on Earth. I mean, the level of mental illness, of depression, of random violence, the level of unemployment there is something like 50% in Gaza. A lot of those people used to cross into Israel to get work. What needs to happen is, eventually, of course, if anybody ever really wants it to stop and stop thinking of their self-interest, yes, it's all about security. Israel can't permit this kind of thing. But in the end, and I don't know how it's going to happen, the Israelis are going to have to treat these people the same way they treat themselves. Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. Or as the Hebrews, the ancient Hebrews used to put it, which is maybe where Mr. J.C. got it from. He put it in a more positive light. Don't do that which hurts others if you don't want them to do that which hurts you. Don't do that, right? But now it's a full-scale war. It's only going to get worse, and you can only hope that it doesn't drag everybody else into it. Is Hezbollah going to start? And they have a hell of a lot more military equipment, and they're a lot better organized and very dangerous. Are they going to start attacking and bombing Israel now? And can Israel deal with that? But my heart goes out to the Palestinians, I have to say. I feel terrible for the Israelis. They're spending their lives in terror there with these rockets going off. But if they somehow could stop this, and if they could somehow say to the Palestinians, and I don't even know if it's possible, because Hamas thrives on violence. It's a fundamentalist religious dictatorship. So they thrive on violence. I don't know what can be done unless you toss them out and deal with the Palestinian Authority. But, of course, a lot of Palestinians felt that the Palestinian Authority was too timid and wasn't going to get them what they wanted, which may be true. It's an extremely difficult situation. In the end, what's going to have to happen is these people are going to have to be treated with respect in Gaza, respect and with dignity. And they're going to have their own borders eventually, whether Israel likes it or not, or else the violence will continue. They have to have their own industry. They have to have their own airport, you know, and Israel is right to be worried. Look at the history of Israel. Look at the history of the Jews. They're right to be scared about this and careful. But as long as they keep these borders closed, as long as they keep the coast sealed and the airways, you know, that there's no air access to Gaza or even to, you know, to any place that could supply Gaza, then you're going to have this utter misery. I mean, a lot of the Gazans, what the Gazans need, what the Palestinians need, especially in Gaza, is their own industries, you know, modern functioning hospitals. And they have this, colleges, hospitals, but they can't be bombed all the time. They can't, just because Israel is in the mood, turn off the water or the electricity to half or more of the country and ever expect anybody. And I don't know what's going to happen now. When you wind up killing thousands of Palestinians, that means that these people, Gaza is one big extended family in a way. There's 1,700,000 people there. And you keep murdering people and they have no jobs. They have no work to do. They don't have enough food. They don't have medical supplies. These people are going crazy, literally crazy there. As long as this keeps up, then the bitterness and the revenge fuels the support for Hamas. I don't know the answer to it. And I have to say that I just don't know. And maybe other people know. Now, last week on the show, I mentioned that all this fighting over the Holy Land. Why are they fighting? Why are they fighting so much over the Holy Land, right? I said, because it's just land. And in fact, it's just a lot of rocks. It's a lot of dirt, I said. Well, in fact, it's probably not just a lot of rocks and dirt. You know, there are holy places. There is holy land in the world. There are places in the world, and they don't have to be famous, recognizable places, you know, like this mosque or the tomb where Jesus' body might have been, you know, buried originally, or the manger he was born in. I'm picking something which seems very familiar, or, you know, where Solomon, you know, had his temple, all this kind of stuff. It doesn't have to be, you know, where the Lord revealed himself, herself, itself to Moses, to that. All of these holy, holy places. The Wailing Wall. There are places in the world, and I've been to a couple of them myself, so I know what I'm talking about. I feel like I know what I'm talking about, that do feel holy. Some places just feel like, well, it's the woods or it's the desert. But there are places I've been to in the world that feel holy, that there's a certain awe and wonder about these places. And you have a feeling when you're standing there or passing through it, especially if you're standing still, or you're touching some stone, or the wind is, you know, is blowing a certain way and stirring up the sand or the dirt, you have a feeling that there is more going on, that you are in some special part. Now, the Chinese have something called feng shui. You know, feng shui, I don't know if it's used anymore, probably not, but used to be that the Chinese would call somebody who was adept at figuring out what was an evil place. If they wanted to build a house or they wanted to build a store or something, a lot of them wouldn't build it unless they called somebody who knew whether or not, who had the sensory understanding, the special supernatural sensory understanding, if it was a holy place or not, or if it was a malignant place. I mean, some places could be holy, and you sort of almost think of something benevolent, right? A holy place. But some places are also possessed by supernatural malignity. I mean, it's a malign place. It could be a place where you don't want anything to do with. And we've all been to places like that. You know, and it's not necessarily because it looks awful, or, you know, it's dark, or it's stormy, or it's muddy, or it's, you know, There's places that people, the Badlands, there's places that you've gone to, and I'm sure some of you, more of you have traveled than others, places you go to where you can just tell that something bad happened and it's not a good place, or places where you just feel there's a certain benevolence, if you believe in God or not, there's a certain benevolence to it. So I believe that there really are holy places, but the tragedy in a lot of places, and a lot of these wars that are going on now are not religious wars. I mean, they look like religious wars, but the tragedy and the absurdity of oppressing and murdering people over an abstract concept or a holy place on earth or a book or a series of rituals or the way somebody dresses. It's insane. We're all human beings and children. I mean, you can put a whole bunch of children together if you don't tell them you're a Muslim, you're a Jew, you're a Christian, you're a Sufi, you're a Shiite, you're a Sunni, you're an Orthodox Jew, you're not an Orthodox Jew, you're a Baptist, you're a Catholic. You don't tell them, they don't know the difference. If you didn't tell them, like some test, and put hundreds of them in one big place, like a playground, they would just all play with each other. And they have their little squabbles and fights, but they would play with each other. And they'd laugh, and they'd hug each other, and they'd push each other down, and they'd get up and make friends again. They don't know the difference. It takes grown-ups to treat people and to carefully teach people these ridiculous differences between people. And then there are no differences between people. These are all idle differences. Are there really separate gods? Could there? It's what a ridiculous concept that there would be a separate God in the world and that people would protest and murder and kill each other and destroy things because of this kind of thing. It astounds me. Of course, it's not always religion. It's not just religion that causes all these quote-unquote religious wars. When you look through it, and I think most people understand this, it's about resources, limited resources. It's about land. Some land is richer in a certain resource, gold, diamonds, water, fertile land where rice grows or grass grows to pasture cattle or sheep. I mean, there's better land and there's worse land. There's land where their oil comes out of. There's gold. There's diamonds. So a lot of these wars, which are fought between what appear to be different religions over religious issues, are really about land, power, resources, and about security, about protecting themselves. People fight defensive wars about money, about greed, about lust, about men out of control, kidnapping and children and women. I mean, this is happening all over the world now. When you look at the world now, I mean, the word civilization seems to apply less and less and less. People are uncivilized. They are getting away with murder under the name, and a lot of them use the banner of religion. But the absurdity and the tragic. Here's some articles, which I've cut. I have a whole file of these things, but why hold on to them? Here's something from Middle East. Israel, Trappist monastery, this is some of these go back months or even years. Trappist monastery, and some are recent, is vandalized. Vandals burned the door of a Trappist monastery at Latrun near Jerusalem early Tuesday and scrawled anti-Christian slogans on the wall. The Israeli authorities said that they suspected it was the work of Jewish extremists avenging recent moves against unauthorized settlement outposts in the West Bank. The graffiti included Jesus is a monkey and the names of two small outposts where security forces have destroyed settlement structures several times. The vandals also wrote mutual concern, which is code in settler circles for the policy of exacting a price for army and police actions against the outposts. Prime Minister Netanyahu and other Israeli leaders condemned the act, as did regional leaders of the Roman Catholic Church in Bangladesh, which is a Muslim country. This is from a longer article. Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina, Sheikh is the prime minister, had called on Islamic hardliners to postpone their planned march, described as Siege Dhaka, whatever that means, by supporters on social media, but they refused. The march was organized by Hefajat-e-Islam, a group of Islamic hardliners who have called for Bangladesh's constitution to be drastically amended with a 13-point program that would ban intermingling between men and women, punish by execution Bangladesh bloggers accused of blaspheming the Prophet Muhammad. And there are anti-blasphemy laws in many countries now. And if the ultra-Orthodox Jews got a hold of the government in Israel, there would be all sorts of old eye-for-an-eye punishments going on, too. And, of course, all of you remember this. This is from, a couple of years ago or more. Afghanistan, violent protests over the burning of a Quran in Florida by a Baptist minister flared Saturday for a second straight day, with young men rampaging through the streets of this southern capital city that's in Kandahar, Afghanistan, flying Taliban flags. 9 people were killed and 81 injured in the disturbances, all from bullet wounds. The protest came a day after a mob overran the headquarters of the United Nations in Mazar-i-Sharif, killing 12 people, 12 of them international staff members. The mob gathered after 3 mullahs at Friday prayer urged the action in response to the Quran burning by a pastor, Terry Jones, in Florida on March 20th. The more I think about this, the less I think it's about religion. The less I think it's about religion. I think it's just all about mental illness, power, and God knows what else. And here's something from another longer article. A man was shot to death in India, and he was a man, a doctor, a very intelligent, sort of decent man, who spent his life fighting dangerous superstition, which is overwhelming in India. For instance, it says here, deadly stampede at Hindu festival that draws millions. Allahabad, India. The pilgrims came, millions upon millions of them, in the greatest tide of humanity ever seen. Again and again, the vast crowds threatened to press too close. You're talking about millions of people come to this town every year for a period of 55 days, and as many as 80 million people are expected every year coming to this town. Maybe you didn't know about this. I never heard of it. But vast crowds threatened to press too close to trample the smallest. As many as 36 people were killed this past Sunday, I'm not sure when this article was, you know, not too long ago, in a stampede at the train station here as they rushed up steps leading to one of the platforms, news agencies reported. The stampede came at the height of the Kumbh Mela, a Hindu religious festival that occurs once every 12 years. Once every 12 years, so I'm wrong, it's not every year, by the banks of the Ganges and the Yamuna rivers. And somebody says, I can't believe God punished us this way, said Santosh Singh, one of the pilgrims at the station. My 15-year-old son got injured. I can't believe God punished us. This man goes along with millions of other people to a very small city in India. Millions of people who don't have food and sanitation facilities, and there's nobody who can control them, although the Indian government sent 75,000 soldiers, security forces, and EMS-type people down there. A lot of these people were killed. They force their way down to the river, and they get drowned in the river. There are stampedes. They get suffocated every year. Dozens and dozens and dozens of people, children too, are killed because they go there and because they think that this every 12 years at this magic confluence of these two rivers, let's see if it says in here, that all their troubles will be taken away. Let's see. A stampede seemed possible several times on Sunday before it occurred as pilgrims jockeyed to be present at the one place and time where the gods are said to bestow their most precious gifts. One problem is that the pilgrims often linger in the water and on the beach, preventing the next wave of people from entering. The police routinely charged onto the beach, blowing whistles and pushing people back with long poles and to clear away for more pilgrims. And they are urged to do this by hundreds, if not thousands, of gurus and magic practitioners of magic throughout India who make lots of money, who make a good living on this. You know, these gurus are brought down by silver on silver thrones and urge these people to all converge in this place. And a man who fights all this kind of magic and superstition, which is obviously keeps people in a fantasy land and never can improve their lives because they believe in some magic savior or hereafter. A man named Dr. Dab Holkar, was shot to death recently. He had a group called organization that he used to try to fight this kind of crazy blind faith was called the Eradication of Blind Faith. And they would travel all over India and try to tell people that that blind faith like this, not based on anything intelligent, was dangerous, was bad for them. And it's hard to know. It's hard to know what to say about this. But people all over the world have faith. I envy people who have faith. I do. I mean, I envy people who have faith. And I don't know. It's, to me, I don't have the language to describe it because I've never had it. I wish I had it. I know people who have faith, and I wish I had faith in some benevolent deity, or that there was some plan in the universe that we're all part of. And I've spoken to some very intelligent people, some rabbis I knew, Orthodox rabbis, who said that we all have a place. We all have our, designated by God or fate, and we all have our place in the world. And if it's our place to suffer, then it's doing some good for somebody. I don't know, maybe God. I don't really feel it. But who knows? I don't really know, but I don't feel it. I don't even have the language to talk about faith because I never had it. And like I said before, I think it's about the way you're brought up. Some people, I think, have the nature for it. I think some people have the nature for it. Some people are just sort of naturally faithful. They actually and I think you have to be brought up with trust. You have to be brought up with trust in your parents, that they're always going to be there for you, or more or less there for you, no matter what failure or failings they show. You have to have a certain kind of trust and hope that things will get better. Because if you don't have those things and you're not brought up that way, I don't believe you can have faith. Yeah, faith. Faith. I never had it. I never had it. And I believe, I guess I'm a firm believer. My constant theme obviously seems to be that the way you're born and the way you're brought up, the way you grow up, how you're formed as a child, will actually, you can predict anything that's going to happen for the rest of somebody's life that way, or how they react to it, unless they have some revelation. Doesn't have to be of a religious nature, but could be just an emotional nature. Or sometimes if they hit bottom or hit top or something massive or extreme finally occurs, and if a light goes off, usually sometimes it's tremendous suffering that can cause this for people, that they will finally understand that they're part of the human race. They don't need to believe in the devil, and they don't need to believe in God. I mean, if you do believe in the devil and God, there is some of the devil and some of God in all of us. Who is so perfect that they're godlike? Who is so evil that they're completely like the devil? I don't know. I know. There are some people who definitely seem that way, who seem to have no redeeming qualifications, no qualities at all. But I don't know. Like I said before, I wish I could have faith. I mean, is there such a thing? Questions. Is there such a thing as a benevolent faith? Because you see, so much faith is these days. When you think of faith, faith-based this and this faith and that faith, you think of religion automatically, and you think of all the monstrous, insane destruction and brutal murders of men, women, and children. I mean, the Sufis and the Shiites blowing each other up, both of whom have the same prophet, Muhammad, and the same God, Allah. Now, I'm not even, in certain countries, I could be killed, executed for having said that, since I'm not even a Muslim. When faith becomes intolerant rigidity and exclusivity and hatred, if you look at some of the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, some of the crazy right-wing Christian groups in this country, when you look at so much of what goes on in the Muslim world, where they're fighting over which is the right brand, which is the right kind, they're blowing each other up. Schools are blown up. Women and children shopping in marketplaces are blown up by Sunnis because they're Shiites. And the Shiites blow up mosques that are filled with people on holy days because they're Shiites. I mean, because they're Sunnis. I mean, it never stops. How insane. How absurd. And that has nothing to do, these ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, or these some of these groups blowing each other up in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This has nothing to do with resources and who owns the land. It does sometimes have to do with who has power, who runs the government. And the fights throughout history between Catholics and Protestants and various sects of Christianity, where millions of people, not to mention the Holy Inquisition, holy, all right, where millions of people in the 30 Years' War in Germany, I think it was in the 1500s or something, 1400s, one-third of Europe practically was attacked and hundreds of thousands of people, and there weren't that many people in those days, were killed. I mean, this just goes on and on and on. And I don't know. Is it possible? Because when I think of somebody, and I know people, I've met people who are good-hearted people who have faith. And I, like I say, I'm jealous of them. I wish I had that too. But I think it's the way you grow up, or it's in your nature. There are some people who just really believe in some orderly universe, that they have a place in it, that they have that things are as the way they're supposed to be, that even if they're suffering in their lives and other people's lives, that things are for a purpose. And I wish I was one of them, because if you're like me and you think things don't have a purpose, there's no point in all the suffering, except that it's just suffering, and that's the way life is, it makes you feel lonely. It makes you feel unattached, unaffiliated in a way. And that's how I feel. I mean, if there was some magic way that I could become religious, I would do it. I would do it. But as I mentioned before, there's fighting going on now in the Holy Land. There is Holy Land, and it's not just Holy Land. There are holy places. There's holy, like, moments. There are holy moments. I mean, have you ever in your life just sort of been walking someplace? Usually it's a place in nature. But it could be in a park somewhere, or it could be you're sitting and looking out a window at the city, and all of a sudden it occurs to you that there's, and it's on a completely non-intellectual level, sub-intellectual. It occurs to you that there's something absolutely perfect that you're part of. And it could be just for a split second. This has happened to me, too. Once I was sitting in Riverside Park in the fall and confused and bemused, as I usually am, and it was early fall. A leaf, perfectly, it was a yellowish leaf and the leaves were just beginning to fall, but hardly any had fallen, fell from the tree, just one leaf, not a flurry of them like you see sometimes, and I watched it fall, and it circled, and it swooped, and it dived, and you could see it, you got a feeling like an unseen hand was swirling it or pushing it, you know, through the air, and it little by little swooped and dived and dipped and landed right on my shoe. And at that very second, I thought to myself, this is a perfect moment. This is a holy moment. And I'm not even sure what I mean by that, but I had a feeling. I had a feeling that everything was the way it should be. And there are holy moments that happen all the time, and they don't have to do anything with, Allah or Yahweh or Jesus or Mohammed or any of these people or Moses. I mean, who cares? I mean, people are murdering each other over this. That's not the way it should be. It should be exactly the opposite. People should be loving each other over the idea of holiness and a benevolent order to the universe. But they have to fight over who's the real God. They have to, I mean, tens of millions of people have been tortured, murdered, exiled, and raped and pillaged because they were the wrong religion. Well, like I said before, it has to do with power and greed and money. But a child, just a child smiling. You pass a kid on the street, like a little three-year-old who just learned how to skip rope or something, or a four-year-old who learned how to do something, and they might just smile up at you, that shy smile of a child. That's holy. Or you visit your grandmother, your grandfather, or your old parents or something like that, and they put that hand out covered with liver spots and wrinkles, and they touch you, and you touch that skin, which is sort of like silky, that old skin, and that's a holy moment. That's a holy moment. Having sex with love, not just lust or need, but to have sex with love, which happens, I think, infrequently, is a holy moment. Any kind of gift that's freely given is a holy moment. And there are also, I think, there are people who aren't religious at all, but they see something valuable in every human soul. And I know people like that. And a lot of them say, well, it's God that's given them this gift of seeing this, or it's because they believe in God and God urges them to do these good things. But there are people who see this and they just naturally feel it. And prayer, since I'm covering this whole thing here today. Have you ever said prayer? I bet you have. Now, I say I'm not religious. I say I'm not religious, and I'm not. I hate religious rituals. They offend me, they insult me, they seem ridiculous to me. But that's just my point of view. Like I say, I have friends who are very intelligent, very benevolent, very decent people, and I know other people who observe many, many religious rituals and are good-hearted, decent people. I just don't think it has anything to do with God or religion. And yet, if that's what they need to feel, it is urging them on to be decent to other people. If all these maxims and all these rituals in the holy books, in the Quran, in the Torah, in the New Testament, if that's what people need to believe, and these words are stirring, that's what they need to believe. That's what they need to believe. But there are something. I mean, there are prayers that are said. They used to say there's no atheists in the foxholes. Did you ever hear that? That's from World War II. There are no atheists in the foxholes. When your life is in danger, like I said recently, I have been experiencing the awfulness of the awareness of mortality after having such a bad heart attack and then after having all kinds of other troubles, which I'm still going through. And, you know, just turning 69 only about a month ago, I am aware of mortality, and it is really sweeping over me. And maybe if I had been religious, or maybe if I had believed in the universe being, progressing the way it's supposed to, then I wouldn't feel that way. But when I've felt bad in my life, I've prayed. But who am I praying to? Am I praying to God, or am I praying to the hope and the courage that may be part of any human being? Is that who I'm praying to? I think it is.
myself in times of trouble. Mother Mary comes to me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. And in my hour of darkness, she is standing right in front of me, speaking words of wisdom, let it be. Sound.